Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining a light on developers' lives from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Brian Pontarelli. Brian studied computer engineering at the University of Colorado. After graduating, he solved complex technology challenges for companies like Orbitz, BEA, US Freightways, XOR, and Texture Media. Brian is also a technology entrepreneur who bootstrapped both his companies, FusionOSH and CleanSpeak, where he currently focuses on solving login, registration, and user management challenges. Brian, welcome to Dev Journey.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So before we talk about your path toward entrepreneurship, how did you start your journey into computer engineering, and how did you end up studying at the University of Colorado?
So I actually started playing with computers at quite an early age. I was about 8, and the school I was going to had purchased a number of Apple IIe computers, and we actually had someone there, a teacher, who was studying programming and had been programming for quite a while. And he was really helpful in just getting everybody started. And we took them apart. We put them back together. We started programming. We were able to sort of get very deep into, you know, machine language and how those things work, how the computer actually functioned. And that was, you know, again, at a very early age. And I continued to build on that. My parents bought an IBM PC. Again, you know, we modified it. We took it apart. We added things to it. Continued to program. In high school, I continued to program and took a number of programming classes. And then it was when I started at CU, I actually was thinking I wanted to try something different because I had been programming and doing computers for so long. I was like, well, maybe I'll try and do electrical engineering or, you know, something similar but different. And after about 2 years of studying that, I just realized that that wasn't for me, and I really wanted to go back and continue programming. So I actually switched majors halfway through and went back into computer engineering again, and then just, you know, kept focusing on that.
Mm-hmm. What attracted you toward computer science or computer engineering at a very early age?
Yeah, I was just so fascinated by the fact that you could sit down, you know, type in, and back then it was a lot of basic, you know, some machine language, you know, some assembler. You could just, you know, type these commands in, and then you could have things appearing on the screen. So it was so fascinating to me that a computer was able to do that. And I really wanted to understand how it actually did it. So I really wanted to get down to the fundamentals. I wanted to learn how did the keyboard connect? How did the monitor connect? Like, how does all this stuff actually work? And that's, I think it was just that desire to understand how things work that really got me into computers.
Is this also the reason why you switched majors? Meaning you started electrical engineering to understand how it works one level deeper?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it. I really was just trying to see if I could find another engineering that was, you know, similar, but didn't deal with computers, right? So it was more just, you know, circuits and logic and like, and those, you know, type of endeavors. And I realized after, you know, taking differential equations and getting really heavy into the math and learning about, you know, these complicated circuit diagrams and how all that worked, it didn't really resonate with me. I just actually got kind of sick of the math. And I really wanted to focus back on programming.
So how did you make your way back?
So interestingly, like I knew that there were a couple of programming classes, and I was like, well, I'm going to go take those, right? Cause they are a little bit more in depth than anything I've ever done in the past. So I took one programming course just to see, and it was great. I loved it. And so the next semester I went over, I switched my majors to computer engineering. I actually went to that teacher and I said, hey, can I be a teaching assistant? Can I, you know, start helping teach classes? And he was great. He immediately put me to work and started, you know, letting me do to teach and to help him. I started editing books for other teachers. So I really got engrossed in just the computer engineering department at the University of Colorado almost immediately.
Why did you want to be a teaching assistant?
I don't know. I really love teaching people, and computer programming and just dealing with computers is complex enough where I think a lot of people end up taking it for an elective and they struggle a lot because they just don't fundamentally understand how things work. And I really wanted to see if I could teach them, you know, at a basic level, how to get through a programming class as an elective. Because again, a lot of the people that were in these beginning programming classes weren't computer engineers. They were, you know, they might be in, you know, taking physics, or they might be doing other majors, and they're taking programming as an elective, and they struggle a lot. So I really had this desire to see if I could, you know, teach people that, you know, hadn't been dealing with computers their whole lives, you know, how to program a computer.
In retrospect, how do you think this helped you for your future life?
So I kind of carried all of that through into my career. I ended up being, you know, helping a lot of junior engineers when I was at Orbitz. I helped do a lot of the architecture and like systems designs. I did a lot of the hiring. I did a lot of mentoring. I did some management as well. So I think just throughout, I've you know, been able to sort of help people learn and get better at programming.
Yeah, it makes sense. Makes sense. Okay, so how did your study go after that?
So like the Golang, you mean?
No. How did you study go further after being a teaching assistant and then finishing your studies in computer sciences instead of electrical engineering? How did your story go further after that?
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, it's a kind of a funny story. So I, you know, I had been teaching now for like 2 years, and I sort of made a decision that I didn't want to continue into a master's or a PhD program. And so the teacher who I was a teaching assistant for, had already scheduled me to teach a bunch of classes the next semester, just assuming I was going to go for my PhD. And so I had to break the news to him that no, I was graduating, and I was, you know, I had a job lined up. And so I had been interviewing at a number of companies, both really big companies and then just a lot of like smaller local companies in Boulder. And I, you know, I got a position at a company, and I only took like, I think maybe 2 weeks off between graduation and starting. And I started, hit the ground running and started programming almost immediately on a pretty, pretty big project with about 10 other engineers.
Mm-hmm. What convinced you not to continue your studies?
Well, I liked teaching other people. I didn't really enjoy the whole studying part of it. I think it just, there are a bunch of classes I had to take, and I just didn't find a lot of value in them. And I knew that if I kind of kept going, there was going to be a lot of research and just a lot more sort of intensive, you know, lessons rather than focusing on teaching or going out and like actually creating things. So I, you know, I just sort of made a decision that, you know, maybe I'd go back to teaching later in life. And, you know, after I had, you know, built a company and, you know, done all of that, maybe I'd go teach after.
Was the idea of building your own company already in your mind back then?
Yeah. So during college, I actually had a couple of friends, and we started a company. Two of us were programmers, and so we were programming it. I didn't do quite as much programming on it as the other one of the other founders, but the three of us, you know, tried to get it up and running and failed. And so it took us about two years of time. So while I was in college and then after I had graduated, it took me a while to kind of shut the company down, but it was a really good learning experience that, you know, starting a company is much more challenging than just coming up with an idea and building a website.
What was the company about?
So the company was, it's actually, it's interesting because it's very similar to, like DoorDash and some of the other companies. So what we were doing was we were going to restaurants and we were taking their menus, putting them online so that you could search for them, and then allowing you to order directly from the website. And we were going to try and fax the orders into the restaurant. So, you know, it was a fairly complicated endeavor. And we got, you know, the first version of it where we could upload menus built. And it, you know, it worked, but we were just, we really struggled with the business pieces of it. Like, how do we go into a restaurant and get them to actually pay us for this service?
Now that you have two companies under your belt, or at least two more companies under your belt, what do you think was the mistakes or the rookie mistakes you made?
So yeah, there's definitely plenty of those. Hiring people that think they want to be in a startup, but then come to realize that it's not a good fit for them. That's, you know, that's a big challenge. And we've, you know, also just hiring people that didn't really know what they were doing or weren't able to be self-directed, because when you're in a small company, it's really challenging if everyone isn't very productive and able to do their job without a lot of training and a lot of help. And so those were some of the biggest challenges that I think I've had with all of the companies.
Yeah, it makes sense. And definitely something you would be struggling with if you were not yet a graduate and still in college. And I can see this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, you graduated and didn't continue your studies and started working at this company where you were with 10 engineers. How did it go from there?
So we were actually working on a project, and this was right around 2000. So this is right when everything was sort of the crashing, and the project it required a lot of hours. We were working like really long weeks. We were trying to deliver this product in a very short period of time, and the client ended up like running out of money, and it was a pretty big disaster actually. But I learned a lot about sort of how to avoid these. Back then, there were just a lot of businesses that, you know, could go get a bunch of money. The business idea was pretty bad, and everybody just kind of, you know, tried to get it up and running and really didn't have a plan. And so I think, you know, during that process, we learned a lot about sort of how to manage expectations, how to not get yourself into a situation where you can't deliver. Try to like really think through the business and see if you can actually make money eventually. So, you know, it was definitely a good learning experience. And I ended up actually quitting after like a year and a half. It was just, the company was kind of a disaster. And I just wanted to, you know, try something new. So I actually quit that job and started at another job. And again, this was during the .com bust, and then the company I had moved on to went out of business like shortly thereafter as well, right? So I ended up just kind of jumping jobs, trying to make ends meet and trying to figure out, well, you know, what I wanted to do, until about a year and a half later, or a year later, and I managed to get a job at BEA, and that was during the time where BEA was, you know, in very, very high growth mode before they got acquired by Oracle. That was a really great job that taught me a lot as well.
Before we talk about your time at BEA, what do you think were the key learnings you gathered during this .com era?
Yeah, so I would say it's super important to have like a business model, right, and like actually plan. You might have a plan, but if it doesn't actually have any components of, you know, making revenue and getting those things up and running at some point, you might want to revisit the plan. And then the team is just super important. I mean, it's super important no matter what size company you're at, no matter where you're at. But the team that we had, everybody was really, really good engineers. And the code that we created was actually pretty good quality. And and didn't require a lot of refactoring or didn't have a lot of issues. And so that really helped me understand how you work in a team. Like, how does a team work together to generate, really large code bases very quickly without, knowing that you're going to have to rewrite everything 2 years down the road. So that was a really good learning experience.
Cool. Thanks. Thank you for that. Okay. Then you landed by BA. What did you do there?
So I was actually on a team called the Customer Centric Engineering Team. So CCE is what we call it. And essentially what we did is we took customer requirements or customer applications and needs, and we modeled them on BEA software and then tried to figure out how, maybe there was a bug or they were running into some type of issue, figure out, how to fix it either in the product or figure out how to build something on top that would allow them to get their features done or get their application built. And so we were dealing a lot with customers. So we were interacting with the customers directly a lot of the time. And these were really large customers with really, really large applications. And so that was a really good experience of just learning how to interact with the business side of things. Like, how does the customer, how to write emails and how to interact with them and how to talk to them on the phone and get on calls. And so that was really helpful because, there are a lot of engineers that can write great code, but they struggle in terms of just communicating and how do you discuss things with the client. And so that was a good learning experience for me.
That's interesting. In almost every example you gave until now, you always involve the business side and the customer side. Is it a deliberate act on your side, or is it a subconscious?
No, it's very deliberate. And I've done it for such a long time. My family has always, run their own businesses. So both of my grandfathers had their own business. My dad had his own business. My mom has her own business. So everyone is very business oriented. And so I've always understood that in order to run a successful business, you have to understand what you're selling. You have to understand why people would want it and whether or not they've actually, really want to pay for it at some point. And how do you actually make money? And so those things are always, core to everything that we do. And I think as engineers, we really need to focus on that. And sometimes we don't, right? We want to write code that's, cool, or we want to solve a problem that we think is neat, but that might not actually be a problem that anyone cares about or a problem that anyone's willing to pay money for. So thinking about it from the customer's perspective is so important to everything that we do. And it's something that is hard to teach. But I think we do need to teach it. We need to really instill into, the new software developers that are just coming out of college or just getting started, how important it is to have that customer's perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree. But it's very hard to teach because engineers are a kind of excited by the technology itself, also when it doesn't really solve a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's this great article, and it's called The Magpie Developer. And developers get into this situation where something new comes out, and it's so cool, and it seems so exciting. They want to try it. And a lot of times what will happen is they might convince the business that they need to rewrite everything in this new language or on this new system. And that's expensive. And it actually can be detrimental to the customer and to the business. And so we have to understand that the things that we've written, if we wrote them well, they're still going to work. It's not like just because a new language came out, the old stuff is just instantaneously, going to fail. And so we have to make sure that when we think through these engineering decisions, we're really considering the business side of things.
Mm-hmm. How would you encourage a newcomer to think about the business always first before thinking about the rest? Do you have a trick?
So I think there's sort of two components to it. So if you put yourself in the shoes of the customer, And you can even go ask the customer what they think, right? You can get their feedback. But if you put yourself in their shoes and say, okay, I'm going to click on this button, what would I expect it to do? And it's hard to remember, like, to remove yourself from what you know it actually does, but to, like, actually think through what the customer would think of. So that's one component of it. That's sort of like the user experience or, you know, UI pieces of it. And then the other piece of it is, okay, the customer's going to click on this button. Why are they actually going to click on that button? Like, what pain point are we solving that they have? Is this button going to, you know, reduce their overhead? Is it going to generate them more money? Is it going to make their lives simpler? Is it going to reduce stress? Like, there's always some type of pain, right? So it's like, if you think about the pain point and the business need that you're solving with that button, it helps to inform you of, should you go ahead and code everything behind that button, put in all the effort, and then how much are they going to pay you for that button, right? So it's a small example, but it's very good idea to think through those kind of simple details and then try and formulate in your head a business result.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. That's very true. But I find it really hard to focus on this or to actively focus on it. It's something that I personally often forget. And I have to actively remind myself, oh, wait a minute, what would the customer think about this and what would they do? It's really, it's a constant nagging process I have to have in my mind. But you're totally right. Okay, so what happened after BEA?
So after BEA, my wife got accepted to the University of Illinois at Chicago to do her PhD. And so both of us moved out to Chicago because I'm a Colorado native. So obviously I was, you know, lived here all my life and went to school in Boulder. So we moved to Chicago and I got a job at Orbitz. And I started off as, you know, sort of just a standard, you know, software engineer. I worked there for about 4 years and just, you know, sort of worked my way up. And that was a really large scale change. So even at BEA, we were working, you know, we had a lot of code and we were working on, you know, customer projects, but we weren't ever really getting to the point where we were seeing the size and the transaction volume and the scalability of something like Orbitz, or at least I wasn't, not my team. And so having worked at Orbitz, you know, I really learned how to make, you know, your code performant, how to make it scale, how to really think in detail about the code that you're writing and the implications it could have on the rest of the system, as well as like how to sort of architect a system so that things can be separate. So if one system fails, it doesn't impact everything else and it doesn't cascade. So that was a great job, and it taught me a lot about just the intricacies of writing really good code.
What was your learning strategy there?
So when we were at Orbitz, or, you know, I was at Orbitz and everybody else that I hired on, I mean, you kind of get just sort of tossed in the deep end, and, you know, they're like, okay, we need this feature done, you know, we're going to train you on the code base, but then you kind of just got to go code it. And then, you know, it might go to production and it might fail and you get woken up at 1 a.m. and they're like, hey, your code's not working. You know, it crashed. Can you figure out why? And you got to go and scramble and figure it out. And as you're sort of just on your own, like, you really have to take a lot of responsibility for what you're creating. You know, we did a lot of code reviews and we helped each other, but at some point you got to ship it to production and you got to see if it works. So that was really the way that we, you know, everybody at Orbitz learned, and we got better and we got more systems in place to sort of monitor and to train and just to, you know, code review. But, you know, I was there, not, you know, pretty early on, I would say. And so it was definitely a different style. It's like everyone sort of fended for themselves and a lot of code going into production all the time. And a lot of, you know, fire drills when things didn't work. So it was trial by fire, I'll say.
But it sounds very agile, actually, and very DevOpsy to have the people that that should care about a problem really being woken up in during the night and have their hands on it and really care for it and be accountable and responsible. This is actually great.
Yeah, we were very – so we did a lot of microservices before microservices was a thing. We had a whole DevOps pipeline. We ran hundreds and hundreds of servers for the main app, and then we ran a few more thousand servers for auxiliary functionality. So we had like massive scale. And so managing that level, you know, everything was scripted. Everything, you know, had pipelines. Everything was very, you know, their humans didn't do a lot of the tasks, right? So everything was automated because it had to be. It was just too big of a scale to sort of logging into a single server and doing something. That wouldn't scale.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. If I look back at my notes, your first job, you learn how to try to create a business and try to create working software. Then you went into this BA where you learn how to make teamwork actually work and create a great code base with a very small team of very motivated individuals. And then you went on to scale things and learn to do it at scale. This is as if it was preparing you to go the entrepreneurship way and really build a big business on your own. That's fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. I've learned so much over those jobs. And then when I finally got to the point where I could build my own company and, you know, start off on my own, I had the skills that allowed me to build everything and put things into place and build great software.
Yeah. Tell us about this. So when did you decide to build your company and how did you actually do it?
So I think it was back in like 2007, 2008, somewhere around there. And I had tried to do a startup. So a few of my friends at Orbitz, quit Orbitz and started their own company. And they say, hey, you know, why don't you come work for us? We, you know, raised a bunch of money. So I went and worked for them. And during the course of that, we sort of needed some functionality that would allow us to do profanity filtering and moderate, you know, different user generated content. And I searched all over the web and I could not find anything. I couldn't find anything free. I couldn't find anything open source. Couldn't find anything to buy. Really, there was like nothing out there. And so I was like, well, I can't be the only one with this problem. I'm going to write it myself. So I started writing it sort of, you know, for the company that I was working for, and didn't get very far. And that project actually got dropped. But I was like, well, you know, I think I'm going to take this home and, you know, do it like nights and weekends, right? And see if I can like get this actually to work. And so I worked for, you know, a number of almost a year, just sort of nights and weekends trying to get, you know, the code written. That startup sort of shut down. They didn't make it, but I kept going and I got to the point where I had something that actually worked and it worked pretty well. So I, you know, built a website and put it out there so that people could come and could buy it. And people started to come and buy it. So there was, you know, there are other people that had this same need. And so we just kind of kept building and building and growing as we went.
You say we, so you had already people around you, but not just you?
Well, yeah. So it was started by an old friend of mine from college and the two of us started it. And we sort of built the first version of everything, got it up and running. But then he, you know, just sort of decided that the startup life wasn't for him. And, you know, it's challenging. And so he actually left the company. And then I kind of continued to go forward and build. And so he, you know, he went off and, you know, worked at some other companies and did his own thing. And then I continued to build CleanSpeak out and build that into a business.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take for it to become a real company paying for itself and your full-time job?
So I would say, so we launched and then after launch, it probably took another 6 months to a year to get to the point where the product was generating enough money to sort of cover me. Almost a year and a half. I was doing a lot of consulting on the side. So I quit my job and, you know, was making sales, but not enough to sort of cover my whole, you know, all my needs. And so I started doing some contracting on the side, just, you know, programming websites and just helping people out and just to fill those gaps while I continued to build out CleanSpeak. And then I would say about a year and a half later, a number of very large companies came and, you know, they said they wanted to buy a license. And so that got me to the point where I could go out and actually hire one or two more people to come in and help.
Cool. And when did the Fusion Oath, I can't speak English tonight, the Fusion Oath journey start?
So I started, so we actually had a team, right? So we, you know, there were about four engineers, and we realized that CleanSpeak, you know, it's a great product, great business. It's, you know, does very well, but it wasn't, that's not a really large business, right? That's just, it's really niche. There's not a lot of people that can afford to pay for something like that. And the companies that can afford it often have built their own. And so getting them to switch is very challenging. So we wanted to build something that would be a bigger business. And so we actually built two different products. We built an authentication system, which became FusionAuth. And then we actually built a forum, which was called Gather at the time. And after we had built them, we sort of just sat down and said, okay, which of these two do we think is going to be a better option? And so we decided that, you know, while the forum was fun and it, you know, could be really cool to build, it was going to take a long time to get to feature parity with all the existing forums like vBulletin and PHPBB and Vanilla. And so we decided, well, let's try this authentication thing. There weren't a lot of authentication tools out at that time that really focused on the end user, like customers. Because when you think about customers, the sizes are a lot different than employees. You know, businesses might have, you know, 100 or even 1,000 employees, but they might have 10 million end users. And so I took the knowledge that I gained from Orbitz and, you know, some the large scale, and we built it into FusionAuth so that we could solve these really complicated problems of like very large user sizes, right? Big sets of users. And at the same time, we wanted to like fundamentally change the system because, you know, we've all used LDAP before and we've all used, you know, really old technologies like Kerberos and they were great at the time, but you know, now we have so much better technology. And so rather than going back in time and building everything on top of these really old legacy technologies, we said, no, we're going to build everything brand new from scratch, make it modern, make it fast, make it scalable. And so that's what we did. So we built FusionAuth.
Fantastic. We're slowly reaching the end of the type box, but I want to ask you one question. As you progressed on your journey, how did your focus change from an engineer toward a businessman, toward a manager? How do you deal with this changing stance?
That's a great question. And you can add in like accountant and, you know, financier. I mean, like when you're starting a company, you have to do everything. And so I think, you know, the mental shift for me was really an understanding of that, you know, I really love to code and it's my passion is to generate really great software. But I also really like solving complicated business problems and figuring out like, how are we going to make money and like, how can we, you know, get new customers and those type of things. So you just have to kind of train yourself, right? So, and I think it's just a mental shift. You have to say, okay, if I'm going to build a business, I've seen businesses that fail. I'm going to build it so that it doesn't fail. And so how do I go about doing that? What do I have to know that I don't know now so that I can be successful? And that's, you know, you got to study, you got to read books and you got to put in the time.
Mm-hmm. And you managed to grow far enough in each of those fields to be successful. That's amazing. No, I really mean it. To be world class in accounting, or enough to have a successful company, you really have to put in the time. And if you want to keep doing development on the side and keep doing management, effective management on the side, etc., it's really a challenge. I'm challenged by this day in, day out, and I'm really amazed that you're so cool about it. That's great.
I guess I just like once you put in the time, right, and you figured it out. So like you said, accounting. So I didn't know what a P&L was. I didn't really know what liabilities were, and you know, I didn't know how to do journal entry. Like, and I didn't know how to do any of that. So I literally had to learn. Otherwise, things would have been a mess. And as an engineer, you're like, well, I have to do this right the first time because I'm not going to refactor my books, you know, a year from now. So I'm going to put the time in to learn it. You know, you read online and you get, you know, ask accountants, you're like, hey, can you teach me this? And I think it's that constant mode of learning. Like, I want to learn how this stuff works that allows you to go further than someone who's just like, well, just tell me what button to click and I'll just click that button. So I think that's a really good mantra.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. And when do you realize? When do you call it a day and say, okay, now I need someone full time on this?
Yeah, I would say like once it gets complicated enough where you can continue to do it, but it takes too much of your time, then you might consider hiring somebody and training them on how to do it, or finding somebody who already has those skills that can come in and just do it the correct way, right? So they can see how you've been doing it, and then they can, you know, replicate that. I think that's, you know, once it's just a little bit too much time, then maybe like 20 to 30 hours a week of your time, then it's probably like, okay, it's time to hand that off.
Okay. As I said, we're slowly reaching the end of the time box. So I will ask my usual question. When you hire someone, since you are a boss, you're an entrepreneur, if you were to hire a junior developer today, what kind of skill would you be looking for?
So we're actually hiring right now. So if anybody's looking, let me know. And the one core thing that we look for, like this is super important, is fundamentals. If you understand how a computer works, if you understand like, you know, how the bus and the RAM and the CPU work, if you can understand data structures, if you can understand pointers and how, you know, memory is allocated and deallocated, like all of those really, really core fundamentals, then it doesn't really matter what language you know. You can always learn the next one. You can figure out, like you pick up a new language, you can figure out what goes on the stack and what goes on the heap. And you can answer these questions about any language in any framework in any system. And so it's less important that you know the language, the exact languages that we're using. It's more important that you understand how a graph works and how a graph traversal can work and like how hash maps are worked and trees and, you know, searches. And those are really the more important, because those are the building blocks and everything else is built on top of them. So if you know the fundamentals, you can learn anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Polyvalence is really important. Have you ever experience with hiring people that went through bootcamp?
So we have. Well, we've tried to hire some bootcamp folks. And the really important thing for bootcamp developers is the exact same. Because there's so many bootcamps that will teach you how to code. And they'll teach you the, you know, how to use a framework, how to do Angular, how to hook up to a database. They'll teach you all of that. But the question is like, how does a database actually work? So where does it store it on disk? How do indexes work? Like how do you, if you were going to write your own database, how would you actually write it so that it worked, right? That's a better question. So there are people in coding camps that go and learn that stuff on their own because they're so excited about technology. They just engross themselves in knowledge, and they just, everything that they come across, they consume. Those are the people you want to hire. Those are the most important software engineering traits.
Cool. Thank you for the tip. We really reached the end of the time box. So if people wanted to reach out to you and continue this discussion, where would the best place be?
So you can follow me on Twitter. It's B Pontarelli. You can email me at brian@fusionauth.io. Fusionauth.io is also our website. And then you can hit me up on LinkedIn. My handle on LinkedIn is Void Main.
Void Main, cool. Do you have anything coming up in the next weeks or months?
You know, I don't think so. I've got, I think there's, I'll be speaking at a few shows in the fall. Nothing over the summer, except for a couple in like investor summits and those kind of things. So I'm bootstrapped, but I love to go teach people how not to take money. So I do that sometimes too.
Sounds cool. Sounds cool. Okay, great. I think we covered it. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
That was really my pleasure. And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey, and we'll see each other next week. Bye-bye. Dear listener, if you haven't subscribed yet, you can find this podcast on iTunes, Google Music, Stitcher, Spotify, and much more. Head over to www.devjourney.info to read the show notes, find all the links mentioned during the episode, and of course links to the podcast on all those platforms. Don't miss the next Developer's Journey story by subscribing to the podcast with the app of your choice right now. And if you like what we do, please rate the podcast, write a comment on those platforms, and promote the podcast on social media. This really helps fellow developers discover the podcast and those fantastic journeys. Thank you.